Coming up next, this week, computer hardware, 960 gigabytes of SSD glory. Thunderbolt bandwidth doubles, Haswell, whatever. Adobe embraces OpenCL. Do you need an mSATA on your motherboard and more? It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 213, recorded April 11th, 2013. 960 gigs of SSD glory.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a new mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting, where you pay for what you use. It doesn't require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twitch.ting.com. That's twitch.ting.com.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, the Twitch show that aims to bring you the most important, useful, and friendly news in computer buying advice. Available anywhere in audio format. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Shrout. Are you there, sir?
Doing well. Doing good.
Well, there was nearly an incident that might have involved of mentioning a certain basketball team of infamy in front of Mr. Shrout, but I'd like to report that that was a terrible audio glitch, possibly possibly put together
just
by
something got rerouted in the connection between you and I across the country. So I understand. It's okay. Not a problem.
Never happen again. Serious PC performance tip for everybody out there, especially you, Ryan. Ryan's big in the PC performance. He loves the faster graphics. He has the fastest CPUs available, but he may not know that every PC, Macintosh or Windows, will always run faster when it's plugged in or if it's a laptop with the battery inserted. Just want to get that out there for everybody.
They will function much better when they have a good power source behind them. I'll agree with that.
Any power source.
I don't know what prompted it, but I agree with that statement.
I'm just saying. Certainly had nothing to do with the podcast starting a few minutes late today. From the so much want department. I don't know who mentioned this on the PC Per podcast last night, but a Crucial M500 960 gigabyte. No, not a hard drive, an SSD. 2.5-inch 7mm, 2.5-inch 7mm SSD pack and 960 gigabytes, $599.99 up on Newegg. And it just went out of stock in the last 10 minutes.
Oh, really? It was in stock for you today?
I swear it was when I pulled it up. Okay. That may have been hallucination
or whisper. Last night it was out of stock for us too, but it had been in stock earlier in the day as well. And actually, I think I saw this for $50 less at some point in the last 48 hours or so, because we were actually in the 50 cents per gigabyte range, like 58, 59 cents per gigabyte, which is really impressive.
You know, I can't afford one, but I want one really badly. Oh, here we go. It is available on Amazon.
Ah, okay. It's a great deal. It's a good cost per gigabyte for sure, but it is still an incredibly expensive component, right? True. So you think about, you're spending $600 on any one component, whether that's the motherboard, the processor, the graphics card. That's going to definitely swing the performance per dollar value of your system. But in terms of being able to get an SSD in your system and have it be your only drive or something like that, this is where you got to go. So, and I'm looking the jump. So it's $600 for the 960 gig version, which is let me do my quick math, 62 cents per gig. But the 480 gig version is actually 83 cents per gig. So it's dramatically more expensive in terms of cost. It's hard to say that. It's not an awful deal to spend $600.
It is a relative bargain should you need the maximum capacity on an SSD.
Right.
Sorry. It's just like, on one hand, I feel your pain. On the other hand, it's like terabyte SSDs. So excited. So expensive. Like, I love me some $500 gaming machines, and I think my last system cost me like $750 with a Core i7-920. So
this would dramatically change that price.
Dramatically change that. Speaking of dramatic changes, or maybe not so dramatic changes, Haswell continues to slink towards release, being delayed once again. Quote, Haswell, we have a problem. USB 3.0 woes may lead to delays, writes Jeremy up on PCPro.com, Jeremy Hellstrom. Hardware.info has recently had confirmation of the rumors we have heard about Intel's USB 3.0 chipset in Haswell. The problem exists. It will cause delays. And Jeremy goes out to point out that this is so like the P55 boards and their SATA controller issues. The nice thing is this time the problems were caught before the boards went to market.
Yeah.
You know, and on one hand, I'm not, you know what I mean? This is not a big, massive, you know what I mean? I'm not looking at Haswell and thinking, oh, this is going to be the most epic performance upgrade ever. I'm mostly thinking like, well, everybody I know is thinking about building a new Hackintosh, or they're thinking about building a new gaming rig. They're kind of like, well, should I wait for Haswell? Should I wait for Haswell? And it seems longer Haswell takes, the more the answer is, no, just get your freaking system now. Am I insane, or am I just over Haswell already?
And I'm not. I really don't even think they're going to delay the release of Haswell because of this. Okay. I think they might delay some key parts. So the issue that this problem actually entails is that USB 3.0 devices are not recognized after waking up from an S3 sleep state, and so
it's bad.
It's bad for desktop users. Probably not nearly as big of a deal.
Right.
Not very often is a desktop machine going into an S3 sleep state. But, you know, when it does happen, obviously you would like your USB devices to work. This only applies to USB 3, not USB 2. So a couple ways they could get around this. The initial wave of Haswell laptops would maybe only have USB 2.0 ports. Or no. The initial wave of Haswell laptops would only be kind of like high-end gaming systems that, you know, aren't as likely to fall into this trap of going into an S3 sleep state or something like that. They're going to delay some parts. And I think, especially if you get into, you know, the super thin ultrabooks where people are really, really concerned about long battery life, they're going to be putting them to sleep quite a bit rather than shutting them down or something like that, that it would be more of an issue. I mean, it affects pretty much the whole range of chipsets, Z87, H87, Q87, all the 85s, all the integrated mobile embedded stuff like the C222 and 224. Mm-hmm. So it says their official statement is that they're going to delay select products, but they didn't really detail what those select products might be. So we'll know more.
We wait with bated breath. It's funny. I'm really excited about Thunderbolt. I'm even more excited about Thunderbolt thinking about what Intel was talking about. Basically, the new another Jeremy Hellstrom article up at PCPro.com. The new Falcon Ridge Thunderbolt controller will be arriving soon. The big thing is doubling of bandwidth, 20 gigabits per second, which basically means Thunderbolt can kick eSATA's ass, and it'll provide signal to a monitor without damaging that bandwidth to the hard drive. And in something as Jeremy points out, it's a business thing. You and I probably won't care. They're promising the same 10 gigabit performance with a lower power consumption, i.e., something that's great if you're doing giant server rigs or something for businesses. And the Inquirer article this is based on also mentions that Intel is still looking to replace copper with fiber optics, because Thunderbolt originally started as a fiber optic platform that got moved to copper. And then, you know, what that would do to the already ridiculous price of Thunderbolt cables. And it was kind of funny because I found a quick link to Canex Live, and I'm like, okay, so a branded cable, that a half meter Thunderbolt cable is down to $29, and a 1 meter cable is down to $35. you know, it's the price.
That's not really any less. I ordered Apple cables, half meter, 29, 2 meter, 39.
When they shipped, Thunderbolt cables were like 1 meter for $50.
Yeah, you're right. They were at least $10 more expensive.
So they're slouching towards affordability. That's going to be the word of the day. The verb of the day is slouching.
To put that in perspective, the 20 gigabits per second equates to 2.5 gigabytes per second, which is, you know, more than enough bandwidth for pretty much everything you could do right now. So, like, the quote from Intel about the release or the preview of the Falcon Ridge is that, okay, this is prepping the industry for simultaneous 4K video file transfer and display at the same time. With shipping in late 2013 with ramp up in 2014. So this is a huge increase. The conversation we had last night was whether or not we actually think Falcon Ridge doesn't make it more appealing to the consumer. It makes it modestly more appealing to the professional user because you can always use a little bit more bandwidth. But, you know, I have one Thunderbolt device in here that we use that kind of pushes that, you know, 600, 700, 800 megabytes per second use case scenario. And it's very niche, right? So I don't really think, I think the 20 gigabit per second doesn't help consumer adoption. The lower power consumption at cheaper costs for implementation may help increase, you know, actual consumer adoption. But I still don't see anything that really is spiking the general public's interest in this way.
At least not with USB out there, USB 3.0 out there. The majority of users still using rotating media on their external devices. If everybody was running SSDs in place of rotating hard drives or their external drives, then all of a sudden Thunderbolt gets really, really compelling. Because the idea of if you could actually fill the 2.5 gigabytes per second capacity, I think that ends up being a six and a half minute transfer of a 1 terabyte hard drive. Which would be awesome.
Yeah.
I can do the math. It's funny. Intel also showed it off at NAB, basically the DSL 4510, 4410, and the Falcon Ridge, 20 gigabits per second. Were you over at NAB, Ryan?
No, I didn't go. But it makes sense that they would show it at this particular show, right? Because that is the video production headquarters in terms of where you're going to catch those people that would really, really be interested in a 20 gigabit per second data connection, right? Yeah,
I know a lot of editors who would be all over that.
I have the 10 gigabit version with a RAID 0 array of 4 SSDs, and I really can't saturate it with what we're doing. So to me, 20 gigabit is better for multiple devices, maybe not necessarily for a single thing. And I'm not working in 4K video yet.
So basically, Shane, this is another case where we have a giant pipeline of bandwidth, and we're filling it with a teaspoon.
Yeah, but trust me, I'm a proponent of over-exaggerating hardware performance and letting software and innovation fill that in as the years go on, right? So that's what happened with GPU performance. That's what's still happening with GPU performance. That's what happened with CPU performance, and we've kind of tapered off. But, you know, and so while I can say that I don't really see any uses for 20 gigabit per second today, Now there's a software company out there that's like, oh, I know what I can do with that much bandwidth for a professional user that may eventually trickle down to a consumer. So good on them.
Speaking of GPU performance and NAB, another write-up from Ryan up on PCPro.com. It's interesting. Quote, earlier today, Adobe revealed some of its next-generation professional video and audio products, including the next version of Adobe Premiere Pro, which is what we edit with now here at Revision 3. TechZilla is edited on Premiere Pro. And it's interesting because Adobe is looking at the next version of Premiere Pro, acceleration with AMD Fire Pro 3D workstation graphics and OpenCL versus NVIDIA Quadro workstation graphics and CUDA. And if you scroll down, basically they're like, hey, it's up to 27% faster with OpenCL versus CUDA. Now, this is ridiculous video specs. 4K TIFF 24-bit sequence content. Those are massive frames of massive video files. Microsoft Windows 7 64-bit, Xeon E5530, 12 gigabytes of system memory. And they used a bunch of FirePro GPUs using OpenCL versus NVIDIA Quadro options versus CUDA. And as Ryan points out, ideally, quote, we would like to see some OpenCL NVIDIA benchmarks as well, but I assume we'll have to wait to test that here at PC Perspective, unquote. Are you suggesting that a GPU vendor might be putting their product in the very best light possible?
I would not only suggest that, I would guarantee it. That they would be making sure to only show the benchmarks that are best case for them and all that kind of stuff. But it's very compelling to think of, okay, are we finally getting to that first major use case where a software developer is going to adopt OpenCL, which would make it cross-platform compatible, NVIDIA, AMD, Intel, all that, you know, anybody that has an OpenCL driver stack would be able to run and accelerate this type of software, as opposed to, you know, we currently use Premiere Pro CS5, I guess, still. And its back end, you know, kind of rendering engine, the Mercury Playback Engine, is CUDA-based. So we chose to use a Quadro card and that kind of stuff, right, for those specific reasons. And now if we can open up that option to our Fire Pro cards and our Quadro cards, and we can do other things with different systems. And now, okay, now we don't have to select which laptop we are going to take with us to CES based on, you know, if it has an AMD or an NVIDIA GPU in it. That all kind of stuff is what I would like to see. Right. And the current generation of desktop graphics cards, AMD has a much better GPGPU compute platform than the GeForce 600 cards have. So they if this happens quickly, they could have a pretty good advantage.
That would be nice.
Yeah,
that would be very, especially because we just built a giant stack of boxes just for video editing. We love Mini ITX motherboards, and particularly delightful looking one, the Asus P877 8Z77i Deluxe Mini ITX motherboard. What does this cost? And is it? I mean, is at this point, is anybody doing decent roundups of Mini ITX motherboards? Like, is there any, like, there's a sentence in here.
Well, I was going to say, we haven't done any roundups, but we've done quite a few Mini ITX reviews. We've done a review of a Gigabyte one, an MSI one, an Asus one, kind of like their flagship Mini ITX platforms. There's one more for, and actually we did one of EVGA, I think, as well. So we don't have any roundups, but I think we have individual reviews of most of the Z77 Mini ITX platforms out on the market today. And the truth, like, this Asus board is actually really, really nice. It has almost the same feature set, and it even has a lot of overclocking capability that the full size boards have. You can see on the right hand side there, that kind of raised portion is actually all the voltage regulation stuff that would usually be around the PCB, around the processor on the PCB, is actually raised on a separate little riser card type thing. Yeah, and it's a really interesting design. It's it allows the motherboard to be small but still have a lot of great features. The BIOS is the same. It has the same features and capabilities. It's got a full-size PCI Express slot and wireless and all that kind of stuff. So it's they're not cheap.
Right.
Even though they're small, they're not cheap. I think that one's like $180 or $190. But you get a lot more than I think people think you get on Mini ITX platforms today.
I guess the thing I was doing such a poor job of articulating a moment ago is are you really losing much in performance or anything in performance compared to a full-size ATX motherboard? Or
is I don't it basically think so just anymore.
Picking and choosing to make sure all the ports or additional features you want are on there.
Exactly. I think from a performance standpoint, you maybe lose a little bit, but only in terms of overclocking performance. If you're looking at stock performance, no, I don't think you're losing anything. You know, where maybe that consideration comes in is you only have two DIMM slots. So, you know, you're kind of limited on your memory, right? So you have to get two eights and you can't add two more eights later, right? So you can, you know, be more conscious of what you're doing there. But otherwise, no, I think the performance you get is going to be the same. You know, just as you said, is just make sure it has all the features you want, right? Does it have USB 3? Right. Yes. Oh, I actually need FireWire. Well, the Mini ITX boards aren't going to have that, so you're going to have to move on to something else.
No FireWire. Next thing you'll tell me is I can't run three GPUs on it.
It happens.
Gosh darn it. Speaking of GPUs, speaking of processors and cooling, speaking of small motherboards and doing cool things with them, the GLID, it's a Hong Kong-based PC cooling company. It's a actual slim cooler. Because we're getting so used to at this point is turning around and saying, like, look, it's a CPU cooler. It's only 220 centimeters tall. I mean, or millimeters. You know what I mean? But it's like, it's ridiculous. The size of CPU coolers has gone basically ridiculous, right? They're going for huge surface area, using the whatever movement of air inside the case fan to disperse the air. And they're huge. And this is going completely in the opposite direction. It's a low-profile CPU cooler, 131 by 123 by 59 millimeters. So it's like less than 2 inches high, including the fan. Weighs 352 grams because You might need to carry it somewhere. And it's the Slim Hero Cooler, four copper heat pipes connecting a copper block to a horizontal aluminum fin array, writes Tim Varia on PC Per. And then basically they strap a 120-millimeter fan on top of the heat sink to push air over the fins and the VRM area around the processor. Up to 136 TDPs, compatible with all of Intel's and AMD's latest consumer sockets. So AM2, AM3+, FM1, FM2, LGA 775, 1156, 1366, and 1155 sockets. So that's pretty cool. It's nice to actually see something that you can fit inside of a smaller case or a more compact case. I'll be curious to see what the performance is like and whether or not it, you know, if to have the same amount of cooling in a smaller package means a much louder fan noise. I laughed, but partially I made the joke earlier about, you know, the PC works much better if it's plugged in, you know, but I've got this Puget system they loaned us, this Serenity, and even when it's gaming, it's almost impossible to tell if the computer is plugged in unless you look for the lights, because it is that quiet. So,
I had that exact same system in, and I agree. It was a little unnerving almost, but in a good way.
Is that a bug or a feature? I was talking about should we take a moment actually to thank our sponsor, Ting, right now?
Yeah, let's do that. So we get the capability to bring this show to you on an almost every week basis. We take a couple of holidays off, but we're pretty good about making sure that we have content here for you every week. And we can do that because of our sponsors like Ting. Ting is a mobile service. You've heard us talk about it several times, I think. Patrick is a current Ting user. And has had very, very good experiences with it. It's a no BS mobile service. It's an MVNO, which basically is a reseller of services from one of the major carriers. In this case, it's actually the Sprint network. But it's different because there's no contracts. There's no ETFs. It's truly and completely contract-free, they say. There's no early termination fees, anything like that. You don't have to bundle. There's no ride-along services. You actually select your plan from extra small through extra, extra large, and you can do it all through their web interface. And you're selecting individual service levels for voice minutes, text messages, megabytes of data, all billed separately. You don't have to worry about, well, I don't really need text messages, but in order to get the better deal, I need to get at least 200 text messages to get that phone bundle plan. They don't do any of that, and it makes things super, super easy. No overage charges or penalties.
Well,
if you use
funny
more than you thought you would, you just kind of pay for that next ring of...
I mean, I've been paying like $3 a month, like $9 total for my service, right? I think it's like $3, maybe $6. No, $9, because it's $6 for the device and $3 for the fee. It's compared to a $60 a month Sprint bill, it's ridiculously cheap.
Right.
But I basically chose, you know, I think 100 megabytes per month. You could choose 0 megabytes per month. You'll still pay your monthly fee for the device. And the way they do this, by the way, is you purchase your hardware. They're breaking the traditional U.S. model. T-Mobile's actually kind of following them down this path where they're basically saying, you own the device. We're not going to do fancy backroom accounting mayhem and make stupid money off of you for 2 years. We're going to charge you a fair price for your data. So I finally got like a $20 bill, and it's like, oh, wow. Well, I use the better part of a gigabyte of data. You know, and usually it's 100 megabytes here and 100 megabytes there. It's cheap. But the idea is that you pay as you go. So if you choose the extra small, the 0 minutes a month, the 0 text messages a month, the 0 megabytes, and you do like 200 text messages, well, they're going to charge you, you know, $5. And if you do 2,000 text messages, they're going to charge you like $8. And if you use no text messages, they're going to charge you no bucks. So the idea is that you're not staring at like, oh boy, I had 2 gigabytes a month, but I didn't use it, and I'm still paying my carrier $60. No.
I unfortunately am guilty of that scenario almost exactly.
Yeah, and it's great because, you know, if I'm at home, I'm using my cable. If I'm at work, I'm using a ridiculous connection we have here at work. I don't want to use, you know, I'm not going to use my wireless except when I'm traveling, and I don't always travel. So I have it for emergency. I have it for business travel. But what I don't have is a giant drain on my wallet every month. So Ting, that's really cool. And it's easy to get into. The devices aren't that expensive. If you want to buy the fanciest new cell phones, you're going to spend a little bit more money. You know, but I got into because we got a nice little discount from our friends at Ting. And I, There it is. Okay, so Twitch viewers can actually sign up. If you sign up at Twitch, twich.ting.com, you'll get a $25 discount on your first Ting device when you sign up. And, you know, it's worth looking at. You know, I'm looking at taking the wife and I, because we have cell phones with another carrier, and I'm thinking about taking, according to the calculator on the Ting website, I could save like $1,500 a year on our phone bill based on our typical monthly usage and the plan we have by going to Ting. That's tempting, especially when you think about it. Don't think about it like this month. Think about it over the cost of 2 years or 3 years or however long you've been sitting with your phone on your provider. And you may think to yourself, I need a better deal. So twitch.ting.com. And we want to take a long moment, a pause that refreshes to thank them for sponsoring Twitch. Twitch.ting.com, $25 off your first device. Save yourself some money on your wireless service. Just saying.
Indeed.
Just saying. Dell, it's funny. I tweeted this out and I got a lot of response on the Twitter. Dell adds Ubuntu systems to its Alienware gaming lineup. You're like, whatever. You're so not into this.
it seems kind of like a throwing a bone to that particular niche market, I guess. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because it's Ubuntu. Okay. They start at $600. They're basically compact mini systems. Somebody, of course, almost immediately tweeted back, this is going to be the Steam box. And then it was like, if Valve is working on Wine for game emulation, it's going to be amazing. It's not a bad system for, $600. It's a little toned down. You don't have the over-the-top insane Alienware style. It's pretty relaxed. $600 gets you a Core i3 3220, 6 gigs of DDR3, an NVIDIA GeForce GTX 6445, a DVD burner, wireless, terabyte SATA drive. That's actually a pretty good deal. Basically, a 7200 to 1 terabyte SATA drive. That's $600. You step up, you get more memory at 749 and a Core i5. And where did the GPU go? Don't you love when you can't read the GPU specs
anymore? The GTX 660 and the highest end models I was looking for.
Yeah, basically the 850 and the 1049 models of the X51 are running the GTX 660. So it's not a $2,000 computer, so it's not running a $2,000 GPU or a $1,000 GPU as the case may be. But I thought it was interesting to see somebody like Alienware being like, okay, we're going to support this. As somebody who's recently had an emotionally traumatizing experience getting my video card to run under Ubuntu and basically moving to Mint as a result, I thought it was interesting, and Dell's occasionally done Linux-based notebooks or laptops or desktops on and off for years, but I thought it was interesting. I'm curious if there'll be more of this. I'm curious if Linux gaming on Steam will continue to pick up pace, and then maybe the quality of GPU drivers on Linux will pick up the pace.
Yeah, I think I'd be more interested in a platform from Alienware that like preloads dual booting.
Right.
Right. Something where they say, okay, we want to encourage Linux gaming platform. Linux is a gaming platform, and I think that's a great cause. But also, hey, we understand that there's going to be cases where that's not going to work out. And, here's a Windows install or something like that. And obviously, you can always buy the system and do that yourself. But the whole idea of buying a pre-built rig like this is that it's supported, that, it's out of the box functioning the way you want it to get. So, maybe if they even had in the software, it's like, okay, well, if you want to do that, you have to bring your own copy of Windows. And then we have a little installer that kind of partitions the drive and sets it up for you and has a bootloader all ready to go and that kind of stuff. That might be worth it as well. Because I am one of those people that needs to spend more time with this kind of Linux gaming environment to see how it's progressing over the months, in the past months and the upcoming months. But
you set up frame rating on it.
I think it's, yeah, well, you can definitely do that. It's just, I find it a little disingenuous to somehow it seems like you're recommending, oh, hey, it's totally cool now to go all in on Linux gaming. And I don't really think that's the case. I think you'll have a poor experience overall.
I don't think they're saying go all in on Linux gaming. I think they're saying, hey, Linux gamers, we're going to build a box for you. There's a difference there, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
Ryan's like, I'm going to sip my beverage, or maybe he's just vomited all over the floor in reaction to my splitting of
hands. I had to get a cable that fell on the ground. I'm sorry.
It happens. I'm glad you weren't just sick to your stomach at my thought there. Linux gaming makes Ryan Trout and PC Per sick. Not sick. 4 terabyte hard drives. More of them are out there. Western Digital's black. The new 7200 RPM. The 4 terabyte hard drive. Last week we were talking about Seagate. This week it's Western Digital. $300, like $289 online. So about $100 more than the Seagate, and using 5 platters instead of 4. So it's got 5 800 gigabyte platters instead of 4 1 terabyte platters. The interesting thing, especially if you take a look at the review up on the Tech Report, is yes, it's faster, 7200 RPM. Yes, it's got a big pile of cache, 64 megabytes. But it also has, which by the way, to put this into context, we talked about like the 50 cent per gigabyte mark on that 960 gigabyte drive earlier in the show, or 47 cents a gigabyte. Now we're looking at 7 cents a gigabyte for a 4 terabyte rotating media drive. 7200 RPM spindle, 5-year warranty coverage. So Western Digital expects this drive to pretty much never die. So basically, you got 3 choices of 4 terabytes, the Seagate, the Western Digital Black, and Hitachi's DeskStar 7K4000, which runs a 3-year warranty and also has a similar 7200 RPM spindle speed. It was interesting, you know, the Tech Report's a little offended that the Seagate only has a 2-year warranty as compared to the 3-year on the Hitachi and 5-year on the Western Digital. I mean, do you think the Seagate's going to be that much less reliable than the Western Digital?
It's impossible to say. What the Seagate is the one with the 4 platters, right? So it has a little bit more advanced technology, I guess I will say. It's a little bit more untested of a technology because they have increased the platter density more. So there's maybe a little bit more potential risk there. But I don't think it will be that big of a deal, I think, long term. You can't say for sure. There are rashes of hard drive failures that go back years and years and years, and it's almost impossible to just try to predict them. So,
good point. I'll also point out that they have not tested. It's kind of funny because you know they make a big deal of the spindle speed of some of the competitors, but they have not tested. As far as you know, they have not tested the Hitachi or the Seagate in terms of performance. But it's pretty fast. Because say the Seagate Barracuda. Where did it go? If you take a look, we're looking at like HD tune write speed here, where a 3 terabyte Seagate Barracuda is smoking the rest of the competition in terms of write speed. Like the WD Black 4 terabytes, like 150 megabytes per second. HD tune's 30% higher at like 200 megabytes per second. Obviously, it scales down, but if you start scrolling down at like write burst speed and stuff, you know, obviously, big shock. The SSDs are delivering superior performance. But it's interesting, you know, as you start nosing around, looking at different benchmarks and different tests, it's always really funny how different the performance metrics are. But yeah, I'd really be curious to see the Seagate tested for performance, because the aerial density is pretty high on those drives. And I'd like to, I don't know, man. You know, is an extra $100 for, you know, a 5-year warranty, is that a good trade-off?
I don't think it would be for me, but I go through equipment maybe faster than the average viewer of Twitch as well. I mean, I think those additional warranty terms kind of say the idea is that consumers say it's a voice from the company of how confident they are in their products, and that's, you know, it, whether or not it actually relates to the reliability of the hardware is a totally different story, though.
That's true. We got an email from James. We love your emails.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Oh.
You skipped the coolest thing of the show.
The Couchmaster?
Yes.
My grandma had one of these for breakfast serving.
What? This was the highlight of the week for me. Was
the Nerdy Tech Couchmaster Premium? Tell me about this delicious.
So there's a video at the bottom of that story, Burke. If you want to bring that up, it is essentially it's a piece of furniture, I guess, that is made to
it's a lap desk.
Yeah, but it's made for sitting on a couch and playing PC games, right? And it's always kind of a, you know, remember when last year I came up with the idea of I bought a overbed hospital tray from Amazon, and I used that, and it had some issues. It wouldn't quite go low enough. It couldn't get close enough to the couch to really be super comfortable. This is essentially two styrofoam, I call them like floats, off to either side of your legs while you're sitting on the couch, and then a platform made out of like a, it's got a wood base, it's wrapped in a faux leather type thing, and it's nice and heavy. It doesn't move around or anything like that, and it just sits there, and it's at a decent angle, and it's got, you know, a place for your keyboard and a place for your mouse. And then if we fast forward in the video a little bit, you'll see when you flip over that kind of center compartment, go a little bit further there, right, a little bit more. Yeah, some right there is good. And so when you flip this unit over, as you'll see here, as I take the keyboard and the mouse off of it, there's actually compartments. You see the cables going into it. And when you flip it over, there are actually compartments underneath that hide the cables. And it comes with a USB hub. It comes with a USB 3.0 extension cable. And it's it actually is kind of nice, right? And so you can hook up your keyboard and your mouse and your headset and all that kind of stuff. I can see that YouTube is not cooperating with Studio. There we go. So, I mean, it's got these little compartments in there that just use Velcro. It's really easy to go in there and modify things and move them around. And, yeah, it works.
I'm really
it
excited works, about this.
It is works that a pretty USB nice. Hub? Yeah. Yeah, and it's a USB hub that doesn't require external power.
Okay.
I tried hooking up like an external hard drive to it, and that didn't work. It didn't have enough juice to really power that. But keyboard, mouse, headset, you know, no problems with that. And it's I played the entirety of BioShock Infinite on my couch at home using this. And other than getting some odd looks from Kelly, my wife, you know, about you're not really going to keep that at the house, are you? So she is adverse to anything that is you know, PC related in the living room, I guess I'll say. But it was an incredibly comfortable experience. The only suggestion I had for them was that it needed a cup holder in it in some place, right? You know, because that seems.
Will they let you choose your favorite leather colors? Can you go for something like?
Well, there's all kinds of color options. Okay. They have one called Nerdytron, which is like a Tron themed color scheme and that kind of stuff. I'm sure it's not license or anything like that. The only kind of drawback to it is it's pretty expensive. They're made in Germany. It's just like a small company that built it and sent one to us. And I think it's like $150 or something like that.
That's not, I mean, given as somebody who grew up surrounded by the furniture industry, this is actually, there's some decent stitching going on here. They're doing some nice work. I mean, it's pretty funny though.
$150 to $170 depending on which model you get. And it's just, it's incredibly simple. In the video we posted in the YouTube comments, there's like, I could build this for $50. I guess you could, sure.
Got a microfiber one.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they have a microfiber one. Like see, there's where I demonstrate where the cup holder should have been too. But it works really nice. It's just a nice design of thing, and it's. People want to play. I think more and more people want to play their PC games in front of their big screen TV as opposed to at their desk. I'm definitely one of those people. So I was glad to see that some of these unique devices are kind of being developed and released.
I will say the Kindle Store does give it a big advantage over the classic Levenger lap desk. I don't know if Burke caught the link in there, but Levenger's been selling these things for 1,000 years, which is a Levenger started as a store for book nerds, basically. And I don't know if Bert can pull that up, but it's basically a sheet of plywood, a very stylish sheet of furniture grade plywood, cut in the shape of a bean. But you'd have to go wireless.
Yeah,
there's
okay.
There's no, there it is. There it just popped up. There's no cable management on that,
right?
But it is.
And honestly, I used the Couchmaster for work as well, so you know I can set my laptop on it where the keyboard is and the mouse on it, and it was comfortable for that while you know. Writing some articles while watching sports on TV or something like that. You know, it is a little big. It's a little obnoxious looking on the couch for sure. But I think if you're a
email
PC gamer,
Kelly at PCPer.com and save the Couchmaster.
She wasn't let down. She wasn't disappointed when it found its way back here to record that video. I keep telling her it's going to come back home though. So
good luck,
I don't have a couch here. So. What are you going to do?
Well, you can buy a couch for work. You can put it in the trunk and carry it home. The home is it'll work. Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv is the email address. We love your questions. Please fire them in. Email, our first email is from James. He's got a question about a PCI Express Generation 3 or PCI Gen 3. I'm currently running an Asus Sabretooth FX990, FX8350, MSI 660 Ti. He's big on the jargon. 16 gigabytes of RAM. The 660 Ti is capable of running PCI Express Generation 3. With that said, Asus just released a Generation 3 version of the Sabretooth motherboard. Is there an advantage in upgrading the motherboard to use the Gen 3 bandwidth or not? I'm going to say no. You're going to tell me whether I'm right or wrong.
You are correct. The answer is no. Yes. There's no benefit. Definitely do not upgrade your motherboard specifically for this purpose. The highest-end GPUs today, Titan 690, 7990s from Asus, that kind of stuff, they don't really even need PCI Gen 3 either. So, no, you'll be fine.
Got an email from Joe about Intel SRT technology. He says, I currently have a Samsung 840 Pro that houses my Windows 8 operating system and most of my installed programs. Nice. I also have a few 2 terabyte mechanical hard drives for pictures and videos, etc. Would I see any performance benefits from installing a 64 gigabyte mSATA SSD and enabling Intel's SRT? Would that depend on the frequency of or how often you access the files on the mechanical drives?
Yeah, pretty much. So if your operating system and most of your applications are on the SSD already, the idea of SRT is it's simply acting as a cache for what its algorithm, what its software determines are your most frequently used files on your spindle drives. So
if you open the picture of your wife, it will cache that picture.
but if it's like long-term storage and you're only ever accessing, you know, a couple of things every once in a while, unless those are things that you have already opened and it has determined that it would speed things up, then no, you wouldn't really see a performance advantage in any way. SRT is really meant to be a operating system level device. Right, so it's meant to be the go between for I want an SSD, but I want the storage of a 2 terabyte or 3 terabyte hard drive, or even like a 1 terabyte hard drive in a mobile form factor, where you have an mSATA SSD and you get some of the performance advantages of an SSD with the storage capacity of spindle based drives. But I don't think it's really worth it to add that to what I would consider, based on his email notes, mechanical hard drives used for kind of like long-term storage. Right.
If your mechanical hard drive was where your operating system and your applications live, then I would say yes. If you can put an mSATA drive on your motherboard and use Intel SRT, do it immediately, like yesterday. Because it's essentially turning your existing rotating drives, your mechanical drives, into hybrid drives, which are going to accelerate the performance of your most used applications. So,
yep.
With already having an SSD, you lose a lot of the joy there. Should we save Alex's questions for next week, or should we try to get that one in?
Well, it seems like you're being accosted, but
they went to the bus stop.
Okay, good. You'll be fine then. Let's save Alex's for next week. We had a lot of news this week, so I know we've been rambling on for a while already, as it is.
In honor of Alex and to get them all excited, if you have an Ultrabook question, do us a favor. Fire it out to Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv, or to @RyanShrout or @PatrickNorton. That's where you can find us on the Twitters. What's coming up on PC Pro this week, man?
So other than the Couchmaster review that went out today, that was the most exciting content we had for me in the last 48 hours or so, we're working on more frame rating stuff now. We're actually doing some video editing and some comparisons of not necessarily what you see in grass, but trying to demonstrate real world visual differences between VSync options. So VSync off versus VSync on versus adaptive VSync versus all these other options, because a lot of people so far have kind of said that if you just enable VSync, it fixes all the problems with the crossfire that we found in our frame rating series. And while it fixes the idea of runts, we want to show that just because you enable VSync doesn't mean that you are getting a perfectly smooth result either. So we're working on some video comparisons there. It's very difficult to kind of get these videos that show these exact things that you want to demonstrate. So it's a lot of video recording, editing, tweaking things. side-by-sides and all that kind of deal as well. And then we also have, we're going to look at how hyper-threading and CPU scaling affects frame rating performances as well. Whether or not, you know, turning off hyper-threading seems to fix anything, the secret answer is that it doesn't. And then CPUs, whether or not if our frequencies drop, does that actually improve runt performance as we turn into the CPU more into a bottleneck? It's kind of interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff. We're going to be replacing the screen on a iPad 2 next week on Techzilla.
No.
It's all in good fun, and it's preparing me to replace the screens on a couple of broken Galaxy S3s in the office. I know a producer and an editor here that have a broken Galaxy S3 screen, which oddly enough seems to have the same miserable to replace, we call it sticky tape or double-sided tape technology, or mastic if you want to get fancy. Essentially, the screens are glued down. And so we're going to talk about the tools you use to do that without shattering the glass, destroying the LCD, and ruining the touchscreen. Or maybe we'll find out that it's really easy to ruin those devices and you shouldn't do it yourself. And we're also going to be talking about some Raspberry Pi tweaks, or basically some updated media playback stuff for Raspberry Pi we've been playing around with. And I suspect, but will not guarantee, that there may be some cooling devices on next week's.
You know, what's interesting is for removing those screens, the kind of glued down portions of things like that, I'm probably going to order this device for a completely other purpose, a hot air gun, but a very, very, very micro hot air gun. One of the side effects is to be able to run the hot air gun along the edges of screens and glue.
You have the
glue
pencil together. Heat gun?
Yeah.
I have one of those. The device you want is up at iFixit. And it's essentially
the pad. I saw that. That's really cool looking. It really is. Yeah.
It's
microwavable iPad repair.
It sounds ridiculous, but it's they spent a year experimenting with hair dryers and heat guns and commercial heat guns, and they finally came down to that the least traumatic way of doing it was basically, well, watch Techzilla next week. I'll show you. That's about it for this episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.
Ship my pants, you're kidding.
You can ship your pants right here.
Wait.
You hear that? I can ship my pants for free.
Wow. I just may ship my pants.
Yeah, ship your pants. Sorry. Billy, you can ship your pants too.
I can't wait to ship my pants, Dad.
I just shipped my pants and it's very convenient.
Very convenient.
I just shipped my drawers.
I just shipped my nightie.
I would like to emphasize that it's ship, S-H-I-P.
You can't find what you're looking for in store. We'll find it at Kmart.com right now and ship it to you for free.
That's good.
That is awesome.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 213, recorded April 11th, 2013. I just shipped my... I can't do it.